So we are going to revisit something which I've spoken about before, but what I'm going to do is I want to do a little bit in more detail compared to what I did previously. So let me start with a bit of an introduction, then hopefully things will come into focus and make sense, and then we'll understand what we're doing. Throughout the book of Vayikra, I kept on coming back to the same point, that Vayikra is essentially a book of law. And being that it's a book of law, any time it is narrative, we need to be asking ourselves a question, so what is this narrative doing here? So when we get to the book of Bamidbar, we do the opposite. We see the book of Bamidbar is essentially a book of narrative, and whenever it has law, we need to be asking ourselves, what in the world is this law doing here? Meaning, what's the necessity of teaching a law in the book of Bamidbar? Maybe a little unfair what I'm saying, but not completely. What I'm really suggesting is, and this is previous suggestions, let's take Nadav Avihu, cut it out, and if we did cut out Nadav Avihu, where would we put it? We put it in this week's Parsha, in Parshat Naso, because it's not long enough and we want to add a little bit more. On the other hand, if we were to cut out the Makalel, where would we put the Makalel? So we can put it, by Midbar is the place. You put him next to the Makoshesh, you put him next, which anyway Chazal say it happened around the same time. So what's it doing there? So again, that's not our concern today. Our concern is the other way around, that now we have a narrative, we have a story. We're poised to travel. We're going to go from Har Sinai to Eretz Yisrael. I don't want to ruin the end of the book for you, but we don't get there. So I personally apologize. I should not have done that. I'm sorry. I should have given a little bit more warning so somebody could not pay attention. But we don't get there. We don't get there. And that's part of the concern. But along the way, we have some mitzvot sprinkled in. Now, something which, if you can do it, is worthwhile doing it at some point in your lives, and that is to read the introduction to Bamidbar. And I say, well, did God write an introduction? Well, not really, unless you count the first three books as the introduction. But the Ramban wrote an introduction. The Nitziv wrote an introduction. Now, here's what's interesting about their introductions. If you read the Nitziv's introduction and the Ramban's introduction, you'd be fairly convinced they were not reading the same book. Completely. It's like reading book reviews. You know, you read a book review, you can read three different book reviews and not know that they're writing about the same book, because people tend to write book reviews about the book they wanted you to write and not the book that you actually wrote. I'm not complaining now. I'm just making an observation. No, I got actually a very good comment last week by somebody who's a real Talmud Chacham who said, "I just finished reading your book on Vayikra, and I feel fortunate to know you." So that was. I said, "Can you write that down? Can we put that in the back of the book?" I think all of us have had that experience that you can read two different. You hear about a book, you think about buying it, you look at a book review, or you can be pseudo intellectual and just read the book reviews like some of us. But sometimes you read more than one; it's not the same book. And over here, the Ramban and the Nitziv do not write about, certainly not the same perspective. The one which is more interesting is the Ramban. Well, sorry, I take that back. They're both interesting for different reasons. But you sort of get the feeling, and again, this is a theory right now, you sort of get the feeling the Ramban is almost not writing about the book which exists, but he's almost writing about the book that he thinks should have existed. The theoretical Bamidbar, by the way, which ends up differently, has a different ending. And the ending is we end up in the land of Israel. As I said, take a look and read that Ramban's introduction. Now, when it comes to the halachot, he tries to convince us that basically God had a couple of leftover halachot, didn't know what to do with it, so threw them over here, basically randomly, haphazardly, and have nothing to do with the story at all. I find that a very difficult suggestion. Quite the opposite is true. Quite the opposite. The methodology which I would employ is every single time we run into a mitzvah in Sefer Bamidbar, we should be asking ourselves, why over here, in terms of the narrative, was it necessary to teach this particular law at this particular place? And I think that is an approach that can lead to some interesting analysis, and it doesn't mean that we'll always get to the same conclusions. I mean, different people looking at it, but I think that's at least the approach that we should be taking. So, if we start with the first source today, the Dabero B'nei Yisrael, you notice already I jumped in the middle, because normally there's a precursor to that. God said to, whatever, Dabero B'nei Yisrael, Ish o Isha, ki yasu mikol chatat ha'adam, lum'ol ma'al v'hashem, v'hashama nefesh ahi, and so on. So this is talking about something, a prohibition, which is called mi'ila. Mi'ilah is a very specific type of prohibition. In modern Hebrew, mi'ilah can mean other things. It can mean somebody who works for a corporation and embezzles the money from the corporation. They would use that word mi'ilah. In the Torah itself, mi'ilah would always have the meaning of taking something inappropriately from hektish, which means something is owned by the Mishkan, something is owned by the Beit HaMikdash, and somebody steals something. I don't want to use the word steal, because once the English will be hard over here. Somebody misappropriates something which is owned by the Mishkan. That's so Me'ila, here, you know, we had Yom Yerushalayim this week. Rabbi Soloveitchik, on the one hand, was very apprehensive in terms of the holiness of the Kotel. He wasn't convinced that the Kotel was from the Beit HaMikdash, an outer wall perhaps. And again, you can speak, it was not because of archaeology. His opposition, would only if you're Rabbi Soloveitchik, can you look at it this way? He said the Kotel's never mentioned in the Gemara. It's never mentioned in the Bavli, never mentioned in the Yerushalmi, never mentioned in classic rabbinic sources, the Mechilta, the Medrash Halacha. It's not there. So he says, if it's never mentioned, how important could it be? Or could it be at all? And yeah, he acknowledged there's one obscure midrash in Shir HaShirim that speaks about, Omed Mi'al Kotleinu, that talks about this Kotel. So he wondered out loud if that was a later interpolation. And he, because he said, that how can you have something which today so many Jews would think is such an important thing? How could it be that in the Talmud Bavli, nobody knows about it? Nobody talks about it. There's no significance. So as I said, he was somewhat apprehensive. Is this a terrible thing to say? Or does this make all the fights that people have in front of it, you know, a little bit...
You know, you shouldn't say out loud.
I can't say this out loud. For political reasons? Okay. I withdraw everything I said. And then, and this is if you're a brisker, can you do this then? Right? You ready? This is being Rabbi Soloveitchik. On the other hand, he said that if you go to the Kotel, you shouldn't lean on it because it could be Me'ila. That you're using the Beit HaMikdash for your own good. Misappropriating. No, one second. So isn't that great? He is apprehensive whether it is the Kotel at all, but just in case it is, Suffolk Dereisa L'Chumra, and you can't even lean on it, or you can start talking about deliberately going under the shade from it, or any kind of use from it. He goes, no, this could be Me'ila. So as I said, that itself, that tells you what it's like to be a brisker, that you could, you know, look at something from two sides and be strict according to every single way that you can imagine, and of course ways that most of us couldn't imagine. So I hope you appreciated that. You can't lean your sitter on the Kotel according to the Rav. It's an Ela. Can't make use of it. It doesn't.
Can't put in a little message.
I didn't say that. But you can't lean on it as you do. The messages is what keeps the whole thing standing. You know that, right? Without those messages, it would have fallen down a long time ago. Okay, so it starts, and now we have to just pause for a second and ask ourselves, so why is the law of Me'ila being taught at this particular juncture? Me'ila would have been a good thing to teach, you know, various places in Vayikra, and by the way, even if it was taught there, why over here again? But you can say, why now? And my answer would be very simple. I have a friend who owns retail stores, so he told me that when his father first opened up the stores, one of the main objectives was to cut down on stealing. They figured that if they can minimize the amount of merchandise that disappears, they can keep the prices low. He says, the other places did not invest. He goes, they invest a lot. He goes, but what are we really scared about being taken? We're not as scared about the scarf or the sweater or the shoes. We're scared about the whole truck. He goes, that's really what scares us, is that... when a whole truck goes missing, because then, you know, obviously then you're talking about being hit for millions of dollars versus, you know, for $50. So he said that's really where they had to have a great deal of security, because once something is on the road, once something is moving, then things tend to end up in different places. So I thought that was a very interesting comment, and I didn't tell him yet, but I thought that was a great shot in terms of why Me'ila is taught now. Because we are about to take apart the Mishkan, right? Vayikra, the whole thing is putting it together. So now we finally put it together, so what are we going to do now? Now we're going to take it apart. So what happens when you take it apart? It starts moving. So what happened when you start moving? Oh, I don't know what happened to that wall. I don't know what happened to that golden thing. I don't know what happened to this. Meaning, that's where I think there may be a more of a concern. Because, again, once you have your normal laws in place, I think people then can operate according to those laws and be okay. But once the thing gets taken apart and starts moving, now we're worried not just about you misappropriating like one little thing. Now we're worrying about a whole bunch of things disappeared. So that may be an interpretation why, right? You like this? An interpretation from retail. Okay? That may be an interpretation why Me'ila needs to be taught specifically at this point. Continue. No, we're blaming every, again, I'm going to say it again. Once things are moving is where there's more. V'chol truma l'chol kodshe b'nei Yisrael. It adds in also a statement about truma. And then it moves over to Pasuk Yud Aleph. So here it's talking about a woman who is suspected of infidelity. And I want to pause for a second before we actually read this and learn this. And this we're going to be stuck today. It could be that I'd be wiser not to teach this. And I actually, yes, you're shaking your head at me and say, yes, you'd be wiser not to teach this. You hate this Gemara. You know what? It's mutual. Okay. So I don't know why this Gemara more than other. Whatever. We're not going there. That's between. Okay. Let's come back to this. But what I did discover, having taught this a couple of times, is more often than not, the people in the audience have no idea whatsoever of what's going on here, certainly from the way that Chazal look at it, certainly. Why? Because everybody's afraid to teach it. So let's try to learn it, because I think that there's some insights over here which are really interesting that I want to get to. So let's begin, and we will tread carefully. The first thing is the obvious. And the obvious is that when I ask myself, so why is this being taught at this particular place? And the answer is, it used the same word. It uses the word uma'alo ma'ala bo ma'al. It uses the word that was used for misappropriating something which was holy in terms of talking about infidelity. Which means right there the Torah said something which is interesting. And by the way, I don't think this is unique, and I don't think that it's completely, completely unexpected, but it's still a message which needs to be emphasized. Again, think for a second. In the general culture that we live in, and when I say Western culture, they would use a phrase, the sanctity of marriage. I like the word sanctity, because what does the word sanctity mean? Sanctity means holiness. What does holiness mean? Holiness means separateness. So therefore, sanctity of marriage, holiness of marriage, separateness of marriage, therefore automatically implies, you can disagree if this is really what people are thinking, but it implies actually exclusivity, because exclusivity goes together with holiness. But how do you have something like the sanctity of marriage when you live in a society which, for the most part, has expelled holiness from the public spheres? And I'm not saying even that's a bad thing. Could be that Jews are great beneficiaries of the fact that it's not an outwardly religious society. But on the other hand, holiness is something which doesn't exist anymore in Western society. There is not really a concept of holiness. So when you don't have a concept of holiness, and you talk about the sanctity of marriage, so is this something which is essentially true or not? And again, I'm going to preach. You ready? I'll tell you when you can listen again. I'm going to preach for a moment. When we read literature, by the way, the Rashi on that means when you watch movies or television, but I wanted it to be a little bit more highbrow, intellectual. When we read literature, movies and television, then you get into a situation, and again, this is a fairly often situation. You have a couple, and it's dysfunctional, and they're not, and she's not happy, and so on, and he's a creep, and whatever. And then this person comes into her life, and he's always good looking, by the way. It's just the typecasting. And we're basically manipulated into the position that we're rooting for her to have either a little bit of happiness or a lot of happiness or so on. But you never say to yourself, I'm rooting against the seventh commandment. You can now count which one that is. I know it's a terrible assumption. We actually know all ten, but whatever. I'm actually rooting against the seventh commandment But that's what happens, which means, as strange as this may be, I don't think the problem is when people watch movies is primarily the parts which are visually inappropriate. And the reason why I say that is because that at least you know is inappropriate. I think the parts which are morally inappropriate or more inappropriate, because that you don't realize are inappropriate and they've manipulated. I'm not even going to call it cognitive dissonance because there's no dissonance. That we've been trained in order to seek happiness, because when you seek happiness, then you'll end up happy. Why more people are on antidepressants and why this isn't working, I don't know. Some obviously doesn't work. By the way, it could be that instead of seeking happiness, if you sought holiness, maybe you'd end up with happiness, because you seek happiness, maybe you don't end up with holiness or happiness. Preaching is over, and let's go back. So what the Chumash just now did, which was, again, to my mind, very interesting, is it introduced the concept of Mi'ilah. Why at this particular point? Okay, we have a Mishkan in our midst. We need to discuss misappropriation. Whether it's specifically because they're traveling or not, I didn't convince you, convinced other people, fine. But then moving over to what the Chumash apparently believes is a parallel case, that became very interesting. Because it didn't say that, again, it didn't say lo tin'af. What did it say over here? It said that if somebody is guilty of infidelity, that is essentially making use of something which is holy, which means the Chumash is saying, please pay attention, hareya mikudeshet li means you've just made something holy. Something is holy over here, and if it's holy, that means that it's out of bounds for other non-holy usage, and that is what the Torah is saying over here in its introduction. Now, I'm going to continue. And part of what I want to see is what the emphasis is in this particular section and how the whole thing will work off of this initial observation that we're talking about holiness. So let's proceed. V'shachav ish ota shechvat zera v'nalam minei isha v'nistira v'hi nitma'a v'eid inba v'hi lo nitpasa. So that's a very exciting pasuk. That could be a whole movie. What did Pasuk Yud Gimel say? It says that she slept with another guy. Her husband doesn't know about it. It was done surreptitiously. She was with him, and there were no witnesses, and she wasn't caught. Pasuk Yud Gimel starts, V'shachav ish ota shechvat zera. I mean, you can't... I'm being polite. I'm not literally translating everything over here.
Yes.
Yeah. Pretty much, yeah. But no, this pasuk isn't difficult. Sorry, take that back. This pasuk is clear. This is black and white. As I said, this is... She
did it.
This is black and white, clear. There is mi'ilah. This is the description of mi'ilah. This is the description of the misappropriation. Over here, something holy has been violated. That's what it's. That is exactly what it's saying. Pasuk Yud Bet introduced the concept of mi'ilah, and Pasuk Yud Gimel spelled it out. What exactly this means? But along the way over here, what did it say? There are no witnesses. By the way, if there's no witnesses, it means it didn't happen. I don't really mean that, but on a legal sense, it didn't happen. Legally, it didn't happen if there are no witnesses. The legal world is a very strange world. Yes? The legal world is not a world of truth. Is it a world of truth? Maybe it's a world of truth. Alan Dershowitz once told me, okay, I'll drop names. Alan Dershowitz once told me, that he had a private... He was visiting in Israel, and I was studying with him, and he had a meeting with Netanyahu, and there was a bunch of people, and everyone else left, and Netanyahu asked him to wait a minute. So he waited, and this is around 10 years ago or so, 12 years ago, so this will explain the timing, and he said to him, so, is O.J. guilty? This is true. This is absolutely true. He said, so was O.J. guilty? So he said, I'm saying when the conversation was. He says, innocence or guilt is a question of law, not a question of history. He goes, this was his answer, when the police fabricate evidence, a person can't be found guilty. Right? But by the way, the courts never find somebody innocent. They find them guilty or not guilty, but those are legal constructs. So over here, for a person to be found guilty, you need witnesses. You don't have witnesses. You don't have witnesses, you can't be found guilty, but that does not mean that she is innocent over here in any way. So, Pasuk...
Keep hearing this
I won't ask what you find worse, but okay. This goes back to our cognitive dissonance, yeah? Yeah, yeah, yeah. If we had witnesses, if we had...
Because the focus is always...
Yeah. No, this section, correct. This section, we're going to come back to at least the husband later on. Over here, I'll say it again. If there were witnesses to this case, he would be put to death. Okay, now you're happier? Dead men are good. Okay, dead men are the best men. Okay. Okay. So let's, but by the way, there are rabbinic or agadic interpretations that when she drinks the water, then the paramour, that's a fancy word, that's the guy, then he, the paramour, then he would also die. There are teachings like that as well, but let's, now you're even happier. I told you, dead man, I never saw somebody get so happy with dead man. Yeah. Can we? By the way, the flip side we're going to see in a moment. We're going to see the flip side. If you give me a chance to get there, we'll see the flip side soon as well. Now, Pasuk Yedalet is interesting because it gives us two approaches, two possibilities, two possible conclusions of the story, or two completely different narratives. V'avar l'vruach kinah, and an air of jealousy, a spirit, I would prefer. A spirit of jealousy consumed the husband. V'kine et ishto, that's a word which is a little difficult, understood by the rabbis. He warned his wife. Warned. His jealousy just now became an action from being something which overcame him. V'kine et ishto, he warns his wife because of his jealousy, and the content of the warning of the wife is, do not be secluded with this man who I don't trust, or you I don't trust, whichever it may be. But nonetheless, she went and was secluded and was in fact with him. Avar alav ruach kin'ah, or he was overwhelmed by a spirit of jealousy, v'kineh tishto, and he warned his wife, v'hilo nitma'ah, and she was not guilty. So now, I need to explain something over here in order, let's go back a little bit to understand what the Chumash did, because again, it's not necessarily an easy flow or an easy understanding of this. It started off by telling us that infidelity is mi'ila. It then goes in and gives us a full, clear description of what would be mi'ila. Then it starts a new problem, which is going to be the problem that we're going to deal with. And that problem is, so now what happens when you have a jealous husband and he warns his wife? And as I said, two possibilities over here. I want to move back a second, one more time. Let's just say that there is a wife who cheats on her husband and there are witnesses and so on. So that's a whole completely different story. Let's say, for example, that he never warned her and there are witnesses. That's a completely different description. This story today in Yedalet begins, and we'll go into two different directions when he warns. Now, what's the starting point? So it's interesting, because the starting point in Yedalet is his jealousy. So I have to ask myself now a question. Is his jealousy because he's a lunatic, or is his jealousy because she has been flirting and has caused him to become jealous? What is the chicken and what is the egg over here? I don't know if that's a good metaphor. According to the Torah, what came first, the chicken or the egg? The Gemara in Chulin says the chicken came first. Okay, now that's resolved. He said everything won't be resolved today. That's resolved. The chicken came first. So what over here is the origin of the dysfunctionality within the relationship? Is it her lack of, I don't want to call it common sense, because common sense is no longer common. Is it her lack of discretion? Discretion means she would do it, but she'd hide a little better. But I don't want to go to discretion here. Is it her behavior which is the starting point? Is it his jealousy which is the starting point? And what's the answer? We don't know. We don't know what's going on over here, which is we don't know what happened. I don't know if I'm going to have time to get to it, but the one who really goes into what I would call, from a layman's perspective, the psychological issues involved of this relationship will be the Kli Yakar in Source 15, so our psychologists over here can have that as their homework. But he will go through how this relationship fell apart and bring it much tighter into the context over here of the Chumash. But I want to come back to where we are simply by reading the verses right now. So we have two possibilities. So this entire process, which is now being introduced, is there, which is going to present a possibility of fixing a dysfunctional relationship. And I need to stress one point. This woman is guilty. The only question is, how profound is her guilt? Which means, after the husband tells her, justified or not, do not check into a hotel room with that guy. And she checks into a hotel room with that guy. She's guilty of checking into a hotel room with that guy. What's the only question which arises now? So what happened behind that door? Which means the very fact that he warned her, I don't know if that's good or bad, but now what happens when you warn somebody who may be innocent? He says, listen, he's already treating me like dirt, I may as well go ahead and do it. As I said, it's really much more emotional and psychological, but the emotional issues which are being brought up over here are very interesting. But again, that's what I want to stress. A sota is not speaking about an innocent woman. When I say it's not talking about an innocent woman, it's talking about dysfunctionality in the relationship. And she therefore, specifically, with the guy that he warned her about, checks into a hotel room, and now we only have one question. So what happened behind those doors? That is the situation of a sota. Okay? If a husband just says, well, I don't trust you, and go drink, that's not the case. There needs to be witnesses that she went into that hotel room. It's not that a husband can say, okay, you're a sota, come down, I'm dragging you by the hair, come down to the Beit HaMikdash. She needed to go and specifically against the very thing that he said about, and as I said, he may be completely unjustified in having said it, but on the other hand, there's a lack of discretion, if you will, or a lack of common sense, or whatever other word you want to use, but there is guilt involved over here. Again, I didn't say the guilt is profound guilt, I don't know what happened behind closed doors, but the very fact that she put herself in that situation is not something which is necessarily to her merit. Yeah. Pasuk Gimel is explaining the phraseology in Pasuk Yud Bet. That is what ma'ala ma'al means. It starts off and it says if ma'ala ma'al, and therefore it gives a description of it in Gimel. And now your Dalit starts a new thing. Okay, now let's start the story from the beginning, and you're going to see that there's two different roads. Veveya ishet ishto el kohen, veviat korbana aleha asirite va kemach sa'arim, lo yitzak alav shemen velo yitain alav levona ki minchat knaotu minchat zikaron maskeret aven. So the woman is brought to the Kohen, and she then brings an offering, and the offering is one of barley, and oil is not put on it, and the levona is not put on it. It is called a minchat knaot, which is therefore a very weak mincha, because it lacks the other things that the mincha normally has, and it's one which reminds of sin. It's one of a memorial, maskeret avon, and it's one which is about sin. Now, a couple of things over here. The first thing, which is the macro issue, then we'll get to the micro points. The macro issue is the observation that the process over here is not taking her to court. Right? We're not dealing with the legal issue as much as we're dealing with the holy issue, and this goes back to the issue of Me'ilah, which means we're dealing with holiness. Which means, let's just say, would it make any difference if I said, bring her to Aaron, or say, bring her to Moshe? That's not the same. Bring somebody to Moshe it's much more dealing with truth, consequence. This is a different kind of, again, if I would be extreme, and don't yell at me now, you'll tell me to take this back also, so I will if I have to, but I'll say it first, that Moshe is emes, Moshe is emet, Moshe is truth, and Aaron lives in a world which isn't a world of truth. I'm sorry for saying that. But it's not a world of truth. He takes sinners and turns them into people who've been forgiven. That's not a world of truth. That's a world of let's work this out somehow. Which means, you know, when we look at Judaism, you got Avram and you have Yitzchak. And there's a difference between Avram and Yitzchak, and there's a difference between Moshe and Aaron. And the fact that this is being brought to Aaron, this is being brought to the Kohen, this is being brought to the Beit HaMikdash, or to the Mishkan, already flavors it in a particular way. So again, I told you, the main issue here today is the Me'ilah, is the use of the word Me'ilah, which is misappropriating, embezzling something which is Hekdesh. So therefore, the fact that you go to the Kohen seems to be the continuation of that point. Then the specific details over here, one thing which is very interesting, and get ready, let's see if we'll get this wrong or not, is that what's introduced is that there should be an offering of barley. Does the Torah ever mention bringing an offering of barley in any other case?
Yes.
You sure?
Minchat
I wouldn't have asked it if it was so easy. I mean, I wouldn't have lobbed it underhand like that. So, well, come on. Actually, by the Omer, it never uses the word barley. It's Alacha Moshe Misinai. It doesn't. You can go back and search it, and you can say, "No, I know it's there because it was there last year." But if you actually barley, it just doesn't say it. It just doesn't say it. It happens to be barley season. It's barley. There's no question. It's barley. But I said, "Where's the only other place that does the Torah say it in any other place?" No, the Torah never says it by the Omer. But it is by the Omer. It just doesn't say it. But over here, Chazal, they comment on this and they say barley is animal feed. Barley's animal feed. Remember when Zaidi, Ima, remember when Zaidi, your father, you put lettuce on his plate and he wouldn't eat it and he says, "This is animal food?" And he would say it in Yiddish and she would, "Shh, the children shouldn't hear." He goes, "What are you putting this on? This is what animals eat," right? I won't say anything. So in those days, barley was considered to be animal feed. So moving back to our barley challenge, yes? I'm going to try to come back to some of this if I somehow succeed in getting to what I want to get to today. We're still in the first source. Can you guys chill? Okay? I've never seen you guys so interested in any topic before. This is fascinating. So the Gemara says, why barley? Because it's animal feed. Essentially saying she was not using her intellect, she was using instinct, and you're acting in instinct, you're acting in an animal way, so therefore use something which is appropriate for animals in terms of dealing with it. That's more or less. And if that's the case, then don't put the oil, don't put more sophisticated things on it. This will be a low-grade offering. Now again, what is her sin? Her sin was being secluded. We don't know. And that's where we then continue. In Pasuk Yudzayin it says, V'lakach ha-kohen mayim kedoshim, holy water, and I want to say, so now we just have one element of holiness, v'chli cheres, umin ha'afar asheyeh bekarka ha-mishkan, and you use the earth, which is from the Mishkan itself, and that's also, I would say, is holiness, because of, and maybe even me'ilah, very good, because now you're using something which is a part of the Mishkan, so using holy water, using a part of the Mishkan, along the way over here, we also throw in something you can imagine, visualize it, like a mezuzah, where you write the Parshat Sota, and it gets thrown in as well, which it would essentially then lead us to holiness times three, or to the third degree. You have holiness of the water, holiness in terms of the earth of the Mishkan, and holiness in terms of the section of the Torah, and then she would drink all of this. V'hamida kohen lefnei et isha lefnei Hashem. She stands there in front of God, which is the Mishkan. U'para et rosh ha'isha. Now this is the only section people like to study because the Gemara, when it talks about the obligation of woman to cover her hair, they take it from here. The word para could mean to be made naked. I would say wild, except wild is with an aleph. I'm not sure what it means over here, but it's something is done, loosening and so on to the hair. So let's pause there for a moment. First of all, when we think about using the afar, I do want to suggest what may be an important parallel, but it's not in pshat, but maybe suggested by pshat. In source number 7 is the first time we find in the Torah the word afar being used. First chapter of Bereshit speaks about creation of man, briah. Creation is something from nothing. The second chapter of Bereshit talks about the formation of man, yitzirah. Yitzirah is something from something. V'yitzer Hashem Elokim et Adam, afar min ha'adamah, God forms man from the afar of the earth, v'yipach l'pav nishmat chayim, and he breathes within man the spirit of life, yidon l'nefesh chaya, and therefore man becomes alive. The Targum Yonatan in source number 8 writes, v'yivra Hashem Elokim et Adam b'shnei yitzarim. So first comment is that we have two Yitzirim, Yitzara and Yitzir Tov. Now, a lot of us would be therefore programmed to say that our body represents the Yitzahara and our Neshama represents the Yitzir Tov, and the Targum Yonatan absolutely does not say that. He starts off and says we're created with two, and then look at the next phrase, V'yikach afar mimakom beit hamikdash. And the afar that God used to create us was the afar of the Beit HaMikdash. So I want to understand this in two different ways. First of all, what's he saying in terms of the physical spiritual conundrum within all of us? He's saying is that our physical parts are made of holy stuff. Like for some of you children of the 60s, we are stardust, we are, I don't know, the age of Aquarius, and so on. But that's not what the Targum Yonatan is saying. He goes, we are Beit HaMikdash. That's our physical sides that are the Beit HaMikdash. And this is very, very different from those of us who have been inundated with sins of the flesh and so on, and the flesh is bad and the spirit is good. This is a very different perspective. By the way, I would go so far as to say that what I would try to work out from this is that our Yetzer Hara and Yetzer Tov affects both our spirit and our bodies. Our bodies are capable of things which apply to the Yetzer Hara and the Yetzer Tov, and our neshama is capable of doing things which are spiritually bad things as well. And the division over here is not a physical spiritual division, as perhaps some people try to convince us. So that's one thing which comes out of this Targum Yonatan. The other thing that comes out of it, or pseudo Yonatan, but the other thing that comes out of this is that there's a direct reference to the Sota. Which means when she is, I mean, right away when I said she'll eat, that you put in this concoction, you know, this is not battery acid. This is not stuff which should kill her. This is stuff which is holy, but now it's saying is that she is supposed to be taking something which is her physical, you know, you think about the barley, which is the animal food, now she's taking something which is her physical body, where it comes from originally in its purest form, and that's what's being ingested. That's just a very interesting suggestion that is being made over here by the Targum Yonatan. To continue with this, the Gemara will then tell us along the line in source number 14, Amar Rava, Mipnei Ma Amra Torah Hevi Afar L'Sota. Why do we bring the afar for the sota? She'im zachta avin labanim ke'afar mavinu dechtiv bevanochi afar ve'efer. Lo zachta tachzor la'afra. Darish rava bischar sh'amav avar mavinu vanochi afar ve'efer zachor banav l'shtei mitzvot. Because Avram said, I am but afar ve'efer. I am like dust and I am like efer, ash. He received this two mitzvot, efer l'para for the paraduma and afar l'sota. Rashi writes to explain that in source 13. Vanochi afar ve'efer, ugfar hayiti ra'ui liot afar al yedei hamalachim ve'efer al yedei nimrod luli rachamecha asher amduli. So I want to explain this in a very, very specific, focused way. Avram says this at which point? So that was in source number 12 when he starts to negotiate in order to save Sdom. Sdom is essentially a city which is guilty. Only question is how guilty. By the way, notice the parallel with Sota. Sdom is guilty. The only question is how guilty. And Avram there says, I'm like Afar Ve'ether. And God, right? And then we have the whole negotiations. So on this point, Rashi explains, V'nachi Afar Ve'ether, I should have been killed by the Melachim. What was the war of the Melachim? When he goes to war to save Sdom. That wasn't his objective. What was his objective? To save Lot, but Lot's in Sdom. So actually, this phrase is used, and what he's doing is he's going back to the first time he tried to save. What's Avram admitting, according to the Rashi looks at it? According to Derech HaTeva, according to nature, he should have been dead. Why should have been dead? To get involved in such a battle, a world war, to get involved in this, he never should have left there alive. So according to Derech HaTeva, the natural way, he should have been dead. And really now we understand that there's a hint, and this is the way that later commentaries will understand this, that there is a hint over here that Avram is suggesting something against Derech HaTeva, which, by the way, is the same thing in terms of I was thrown into an altar. I should have been burnt. According to Teva, nature, I should have been dead, and therefore to be able to leave death, the cancellation of death is what? That's the paraduma connected to these two things. What we have in both of these cases are, in a sense, of something which goes against nature, against Teva, as it were, full stop. And let's go back and try to see how far we can now get to today. The other reference that I would go to is source number 2. Source number 2 is immediately after the Cheta Egel. V'yikasher karav el ha-machaneh, v'yar et ha-egel u'macholot, v'yichar af Moshe, v'yashalech miyadav et ha-luchot, v'yashaber otam tachat ahar. V'yikach et ha-egel asher asa, v'yisrof va'esh, v'yotchan ad asher dak, v'yizo p'nei ha-mayim, v'yashak p'nei Yisrael. After the Cheta Egel, what does Moshe do? He grinds the Egel down into dust, he mixes it with water, and he makes them drink it, which is exactly the process of the Sota. The only question that I have, does the law of the Sota follow after Moshe already did this, Or does Moshe already know the law of Sota and therefore he behaves this way? Which is, of course, interesting because in a technical level, this isn't Sota. This is Avodah Zarah. One more element over here. In verse 25, Pasuk Kaf Hei, it says, Vayar Moshe ta'am ki paruahu, ki paro aron l'sham tzavik hameyem, and the same word was used in terms of parua. They're naked, right? They're uncovered. Their sin has been uncovered. So now you realize the connection with the Sota is twofold. One in terms of content, and two linguistically, that we have the same thing. So therefore, it's very close. I want to point something out, which again, I think, I'm sure I've mentioned this before, but I want you to see exactly why this is significant. There's a Rashi in Shir HaShir. This is one of the, I told you, I am very unpopular in modern Orthodox circles because I like Art Scroll. I don't complain about them. I like them. In order to really to prove that you went to YU or certainly to Gush, you have to complain publicly about Art Scroll. So therefore, I have failed in that particular mission. But, and again, I think the Gemarot are great. I think certain things are great. Sometimes they get a little funny. And one of the funny things is the translation to Shir HaShirim. Because the translation to Shir HaShirim, it's idiosyncratic, and the translation chooses not to translate in the literal sense anything. It goes straight to a metaphoric sense, and therefore, when in Shir HaShirim, which is a love story, which describes in quite graphic terms parts of the female anatomy and expresses the love, so it can't say that, so therefore, instead of talking about two breasts, the translation in Art Scroll there is Moshe and Aaron, because that's what feeds the Jewish people, as it were. So, but if you look at Rashi on that pasuk, Rashi says it actually refers to the Aseret HaDibrot. It's one of his number of interpretations. And that's where Rashi says that the Aseret HaDibrot are described, again, in that visual, where he sees it as 5 and 5, and not as 1 to 10. And that's where Rashi tells us, based upon the Midrash, that the way to read the Aseret HaDibrot is to read them across rather than read them down. And when you get to the second one, which is not to have any other gods, think Cheta Egel, you read across, what does it say? Not to commit adultery. Which therefore, and now think about Sota, which therefore, when we read how the Cheta Egel is treated, and then we read the Parshat Sota, you realize that that really worked very well off of what Rashi was saying of reading the Aseret HaDibrot across, because on a conceptual level, this is really the same thing, which I think, if anything, strengthens this issue of Kadshim. Now, the one thing I want to come back to and put a little bit more emphasis on is what I said in terms of Avram's prayer and the Derech HaTeva and the not Derech HaTeva. So I want to add a couple of things along the way. First of all, at the very, very end, and I'm going to skip the whole explosion and so on. So those of you that love that, you'll do that on your own. When we get to the very end, V'nika ha'ish me'avon, and the man will be cleansed of his sin, v'isha hitisat avonah, and the woman, Source 1, Pasuk Lamed Aleph, V'nika ha'ish me'avon, the man will be cleansed of his sin, v'isha hitisat avonah, and she will bear her sin. I think the pshat means, what happens if she dies? So this is her responsibility. He didn't kill her. Or you can say, why did her husband do this to her wife? By the way, I'm reading a lot of this, and I like the Gemara Sota, I don't know about you. And the Mishnayot are very interesting, and I'm going to come back, if I can, to a couple of them. But it's very clear along the way, she can always stop this process. She can say, I'm guilty. And what happens if she says she's guilty? Only one thing. No. She gets a divorce. She loses her ketuvah. She's guilty of marital malpractice by having cheated on her husband. She loses her ketuvah and moves on with her life. That's it. No. Sorry to disappoint you. I know people are so disappointed about this. She doesn't get killed. No. There's no witnesses. She doesn't get killed. No witnesses. Okay. I'm going to try this again. What if a woman goes over to her husband and says, I cheated on you, therefore divorce me. So what can he say? Prove it. Bring witnesses. I don't believe you. And he's under no obligation to divorce her. That's the mission at the end of Gittin. What if he warned her not to be with somebody, and she went with somebody, and then she says, okay, I'm guilty. Now he has to divorce her. By having warned her, he just now was forced to give the get. So I'm saying that's part of entering into this process, which may have been unexpected consequences. Once he warns her, as I said, we just now entered into a whole different type of a process over here. So he warns her, she says, I'm guilty, give the get, walk away, lose the ketuvah, end of story. He has no choice because he warns her. That just changed the whole thing. The fact that he warned her changed the whole debate over here. Now he has to divorce her. So now let's go back again. If she's guilty, what should she do? If she's guilty, presumably what she should do is, I mean, there's a great midrash, the midrash about the two sisters. So it says that that she had a twin sister. So she had her sister go and drink the water. Of course, her sister was innocent, so drinking the water, nothing happened. So then she came back and saw her sister, and she kissed her, and then the water went from one to the other, and the other one exploded. That's a great, I mean, such a, and it teaches the kids. This is like the best, just be careful, because it can get you from a cliche-ny. Like, now, to throw confusion upon everything, we get to the Mishnah in Sota. The Mishnah says, and this is in source 22, im yesh la schut, if the woman has accrued merit, hayta tolala, the water wouldn't kill her right away. Yesh schut tolala shanachat, she should have some good merit that can give her a year. Yesh schut tolala shnei shanim, and some merit that can give her 2 years. Yesh schut tolala shalosh shanim, and she can have merit that gives her 3 years. Mikan omer ben azai, and this nobody knows because they always learn this out of context. And this is why Ben Azai said, "Chayav adam lamei bito Torah." Someone should teach his daughter Torah. She'im tishte, and she's guilty. Teidash eschut tolalash. You should know that she was saved because of the learning that she did. That's unbelievable because nobody ever even considers this. The context that he said this thing. And Rabbi Lezer Omer, and we turn him into the world's greatest misogynist. He says, "Kol malam bito Torah ki lalamdo tiflud." He goes, "What are you talking about? If you teach her Torah and therefore she gets saved, she's going to now think that she can have an affair. I'm going to learn. Listen, I got okay. I'm going to cheat on my husband. I got to learn six blot of Gemara first because then this should give me a time." Sir Blazer says, "What are you talking about? This is crazy." Rabbi Shimon Omer, Shimon Bar Yochai, "Ein zchuto lebemayim ma'orim." He goes, "No, this can't help. If you say it does, zchuto lebemayim ma'orim, matata demayim b'nei kol anoshim shotot, umotziata shemra l'taharot." So now, what have you accomplished? Anybody who goes through this process, well, she sort of made it. Well, yeah, what do you? Of course, she made it. Have you taste her cheesecake? You know how many people? You know what kind of nice woman this is? What kind of mitzvah she's done? Of course the water didn't kill her. So now what is all of this? She goes, "What are you talking about?" So that is one side which is very interesting. By the end of the day, the Mishnah writes in 21, Misharabu min afim, when there already became so many people who were guilty of infidelity, pasku amayim arim. And this is based upon the Gemara in source number 18. V'nika ish me'avon. Here the Gemara explains it differently the way that I explained it. What did I say that the Pasuk means in Pshat? That the man is not guilty for his wife having died because he didn't do it. She did this. She should have said, "I'm guilty." But, right? And not just, "But I've been learning." Va'isha hitisa davona. Right? Bizman sha'ish menuke me'avon. When the husband is innocent, hamayim bot ginadishto. Eina ish menuke me'avon, eina mayim bot ginishko. Which means if he's not innocent, it doesn't. How far does this go? So Rashi, who's in source 19, which I'm not going to read, says that from the time that he warned her, because she was secluded, if he slept with her then the whole deal is off. Because obviously he doesn't take any of this seriously. Right. If he sleeps with his own wife after she was secluded, then he doesn't take it seriously. That's how Rashi interprets it. The Rambam, on the other hand, source number 20, Kol Ish, Sheba Bia Asura Miyamav, any man who had ever was guilty of having any kind of illicit sexual relationship, acha shehigdil, to be very clear, after he became a bar mitzvah. I'm pretty clear no one's going to use the first part as sheva bracha, so nobody's going to use this for bar mitzvah talk, right? But from the time that he's bar mitzvah, ein hamayim hama'orim botkimet ishto. If you're a pig, don't expect for a miracle to take place. Because that's what I want to say. This is a miracle. Don't expect for something supernatural to take place if you're a pig which is going to go ahead and kill your wife. So why was it? Did it end? Well, there were so many people that were dishonest along the way, so of course this didn't work. Which means I want to just go back to the beginning and try to wrap this up. The whole law of Sota is introduced as something of kudshim. It deals with holiness. It compares it to embezzlement. The process is one of using water which is holy, part of the Beit HaMikdash or the Mishkan which is holy, using the Torah which is holy. The direct comparison is the comparison to the way that the Jews were treated right after they were guilty with the golden calf. How do we understand that? Reading the Aseret Yedroth across, that essentially, that cheating on one's spouse is like cheating with God. But why? Because it's Kadshim. Again, that's exactly the point. Because it's Kadshim, now that parallel just became a lot tighter. The default is that if somebody drinks this concoction, nothing happens. Why does nothing happen? Because it's water. Nothing happens. In order for something to happen, a miracle has to take place, which then leads me, what kind of person is deserving to have a miracle take place for them? The purpose of this whole thing was to take a dysfunctional relationship, and again, he warns her, he may be wrong. She is secluded, she's wrong. We're stuck, drinks the water. It's not a comfortable situation, but I'm going to say it again. She was already guilty of at least one indiscretion, of having been secluded. And what happens then? Nothing happens. So if nothing happens, so then they can continue. And now it's proven to him. It's proven to him that nothing happens, so therefore she's innocent and go out in marriage. So therefore, this whole thing is in order to create, at least for him, to take away his kin'ah, take away his jealousy, calm him down, and give him what I would call yishuv hadat. Now there's only one problem with all this. If he's not deserving of it. So therefore, if you're a sinner, you don't deserve yishuv hadat. You don't deserve to be judging other people, which means we're looking back for some kind of, I would say, I don't want to say exactly equality, because he'll yell at me again, but by the time we're finished with this, and we got to the Rambam, that just became very, very interesting. If you're a pig, you are not deserving to have yishuv hadat. You're not deserving to be pointing fingers at other people. And don't expect miracles to take place in order to try to help you. You need to work with your own anger, whatever. You need to work on your own relationship differently. So therefore, this is a miraculous action which God will do. By the way, going back to Avram Avinu, going against the Teva, but in order to deserve for this to happen, you need to be maybe be more like Avram Avinu in order to deserve for the miraculous to take place.